Welcome, everybody, to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am your host, Jason Verlinde. Every week on this show, I interview someone fascinating from the world of guitar and guitar culture. As you hopefully know, the Fretboard Journal podcast is sponsored by Peghead Nation, Isotope, Stringjoy Strings, and Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar. And today on the show, I'm talking to Mike Ball of Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar. Now, I got to admit, Mike and Mike's is literally, as the crow flies, the closest guitar store to where I'm sitting here at the Fretboard Journal. They are located here in Seattle, Washington. Because they are sort of the local store to me, I have watched them grow over the last decade exponentially. Out of a garage where they originally were serving the occasional beer or cocktail, hence the bar part, to an incredible store in the Fremont neighborhood of Seattle. They also have this kind of unique point of view, which I think is pretty interesting. They bring in guitars from Japan. They've got a wide array of vintage guitars, but they kind of know what their wheelhouse is. They're really eclectic. I had no idea just how many instruments they had in their inventory. So I wanted to have Mike on the show, and that is the conversation you're about to hear. I get to ask all the dumb questions as a non-guitar store owner as to how a store operates in 2023 and now 2024, and it was a lot of fun. Before we get to my conversation with Mike, I just want to thank you all for what has been an incredible 2023, our most downloads ever. I feel like it kind of started with the G. Weller episode that we released back in April. We've had Hand Habits. We've had Guru Singh, the yogi. We had Matt Sweeney of Guitar Moves just in the last few months. It has been such an incredible ride. And for 2024, I assure you, we are going to continue to mix things up. This is not a gear podcast. There are plenty of those that do incredible work. We're going to have fun meeting interesting people in a unique way on this podcast. And I'm so glad you're here for the journey with me. Now, like I said, you're going to love hearing from Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar. They're sponsoring the podcast. If you are out there and making lists, making resolutions for 2024, and one of those includes being a better musician, Peghead Nation has you covered. You can get your first month free or $20 off of an annual subscription with the promo code FRETBOARD when you check out. Isotope also has you covered. Use the discount code FRET10 when you check out to save 10% off of Isotope. And Stringjoy Strings has you covered too. If you use the discount code FRETBOARD, you can save 10% off of your first order at stringjoy.com. Maybe your New Year's resolution is just to finally change the strings on that one guitar or mandolin you barely ever touch and you know it needs a string change. Stringjoy has you covered. Now we're going to hear my conversation with Mike Ball talking about all things running a guitar store. I learned a lot from this conversation. I hope you will too. We have a ton of fun episodes in store for 2024 already. So my ask for you all is, if you love the show, leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts. It goes such a long way towards helping others find it. And if you really, truly love the show and want to support it, we do have a Patreon for it. I'll include a link in the show notes. Now, here's my conversation with Mike Ball of Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar. Mike Ball, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Well, thanks. Happy to be here.
So I think your story and the Mike and Mike story is super fascinating because, and my timeline is probably way off, but I can remember, and it doesn't feel like it was that long ago, you guys had a store in a basement of a modest house here in Ballard, Washington, outside of Seattle.
Yep.
And it was funky and, you know, what you would think a couple of guys who love guitars and start selling guitars. It was sort of just a homebrew operation. And now there's this like crazy store in Fremont. How long ago was that chapter?
That was, almost 8 years ago.
Okay.
Now, but it was a solid 5 years in the garage before we moved out to our current showroom and started building that space kind of room by room to what the operation is now. But I love the garage. People are still sentimental about those days.
I remember going over there by myself, sometimes with Bill Frizzell, and you'd have to bang on the actual garage door and have somebody roll it up. Like it was a whole thing.
Oh yeah. I mean, I had just gotten off of tour. And it was like Christmas Eve 2011 down in Fremont. And I was having dinner with my family. And I was like, no, I think I'm going to open this guitar shop and we're going to call it Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar. Uh-huh. And of course the other Mike Adams was on board. And my girlfriend at the time, she was traveling the country as a physical therapist. And I found a little duplex in Ballard and I shot a little video of it. And I said, hey, why don't you come here to Seattle and we'll live together and I'll start a guitar shop in the basement. And what do you think? And she said, yeah, that sounds all right. And that's my wife.
So you've picked that house out to rent because you thought it could, you could operate a little mini guitar store in it?
Yeah. Well, it was right at the end of a row of businesses. And I was like, well, there's businesses and there's a garage door right here. And we can figure out the rules for what a home business signage could look like. Mm-hmm. And if I just opened up this garage, maybe we could do something here.
I had no idea. I assumed you were just living there already in the little homebrew operation grew, but you picked the place out for potential guitar store ownership. That's cool.
Yeah. I said, hey, there's maybe 400 square feet in this basement. That seems like a responsible place to start a company.
It was a classic Seattle 40s or 50s house or whenever, where it could barely, probably couldn't even fit in a normal modern car in the garage anymore.
It was very narrow, but it's extremely long.
Yeah.
So that we were able to fit like storage, a shipping department, and like a wall of 40 to 50 amps just right there in the garage before you took a hard turn into, yeah. I mean, we had four people working in there. We had guitar repair going on. We had shipping. We had, you know, a showroom in quotes.
Yeah.
People would come in and we would interact with the public in that space. I mean, everything was happening in 400 square feet for 5 years while we built the e-commerce side of it and had something that was sustainable. And really, there was just no way we could continue operating in that space.
Yeah.
You know, once it grew as it was so grateful that it did.
And then you didn't really go baby steps when you moved out. You went big.
Well, we looked for almost 2 years before we found the space in Fremont. And I mean, it was an absolute dream to find a space that was like a little almost boutique-y early 1900s, 900 square foot showroom, but that had this huge two-story building built on the back of it. So you got to come in and you got to feel this warmth and this intimacy of the space. But then you had all of this room to actually, for the operation to grow and exist. And we built that room by room. I mean, when we opened in Fremont, it was just really that 900 square feet right in front. And then we methodically kind of themed and built out every space of it as the business, you know, required that need.
And you guys kind of occupy, I mean, every big city has a handful of cool guitar store. Seattle is no exception, but you guys kind of occupy a unique place where I feel like you kind of had more of a national and international presence before you even had like a local presence. Is that true?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, since we built it on the e-commerce side and we built it to be sustainable in that way. But for me, the most feeding thing is actually, you know, showing people through the showroom and kind of guiding them through that experience. So that was something that I just wanted to kind of feed the soul of the business, was to have that physical presence in a place people would come. Because I mean, even when we were in the garage, people were coming from all over the world to come to the garage, which was hilarious. Like, we come from Australia, people coming from Europe, just wanting to experience, you know, I've got to imagine it's similar to Fretboard, where there's this intimate space and people know this outsized impression of it, and they just want to come and be in the epicenter of the thing.
Yeah, I'm still in basically a garage though.
Oh, no.
we didn't self-talk. Scale up. What is Mike and Mike's look like now? How many employees? How big is that space?
So sorry, I keep clearing my throat here. So we have two buildings in Fremont now. So we expanded almost 2 years ago into two stories of our building next door. So there's just shy of 20 people that make the show go. And, you know, two buildings, two stories each, 6,000 square feet, something like that. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. And I'm humbled and gratified that people trust us and continue to bring their business to us so that it does continue to grow in this way, because I could have never expected it to be where it is now when we came out of the garage days, for sure. But it continues to delight me how much trust people put in us and how we can continue to grow the thing.
And stores often have their niche. We've got here just in Seattle, Dusty Strings down the street from you is sort of the folky acoustic store. It's been around forever. Emerald City Guitars has their Bursts and all their Dumbles and all the amazing high-end stuff. What is the bread and butter for Mike and Mike's right now in terms of like what, if you had to describe like where the bulk of your focus is?
Well, first, when we added that new building, most of that was to service guitar restoration and guitar service, mm-hmm. where we were, again, it's like we were running at capacity in our original building where we had four benches. We had amp techs and guitar techs working back to back in practically a hallway. And we wanted to add, you know, 20, 30 some feet of bench space and create room just for the guitar restoration end of it to thrive and expand and to provide that community resource in a much deeper way than we'd been able to historically. So that was just a huge component of that expansion. So we could have, we have as many as seven techs in house to make it go, because we see, you know, 200 some pieces a month. And I'm not talking, you know, pedals and mm-hmm. bits and bobs. I'm talking guitars and amps and synths and mm-hmm. combo organs and whatnot. So, I mean, it really takes a village to make it all happen at the level of quality that we want to, at the curation and the vetting to make everything the best it can be.
Yeah. You have that whole second half of repair. And are you're doing repairs on every guitar? I know you're doing repairs on amps because Jesse Quitsland, who's often a contributor to the Truth About Vintage Amps, is working there.
Yes. And Jim Roth is our other in-house amp tech, and those two get along like gangbusters.
Of course. Yeah. So you're taking in, because sometimes you'll go to a store and they'll be like, yeah, we can maybe see your guitar in 6 months or something. You're taking stuff in all the time. Turnaround of what?
We try to keep it to as low as 3 weeks is ideal. 2 to 3 weeks would be amazing if we can keep that turn. Sometimes it balloons out to about five.
Yeah.
But we can have as many as 100 customer instruments in the queue and amps and things at any time, in addition to 200 pieces of gear coming in the door every month that all need very specific attention.
Yeah.
There isn't a piece of gear that we get that doesn't go through that deep vetting process, even at intake, kind of identifying what it needs. That bounces up to me. Then it goes into the service department and those techs, and we all collaborate on what the best thing to do with any vintage piece is, because it's all used, it's all vintage, it all needs something.
Sure.
And, you know, then it bounces over to photo and we really do the forensics. We take it all apart. Then it goes to myself and our other copywriter. And then we do a whole nother round of QC and vetting and asking questions. You know, that all happens before anything mm-hmm. even gets presented and out there to the public. So
where do you guys, I'm always fascinated because like guitar shows, I think, are kind of a shell of what they used to be.
Yeah.
Everyone can make a kind of pro looking reverb store and name their price on whatever they've been collecting for years. Like, where do you guys find guitars and where you're able to buy them? And then obviously you need to make a profit. You need to stay in business. Like where are they coming from? Existing clients? Are you going on these guitar safari things that we hear about or what?
Yeah. I don't get to do as many of those as I would like, but there have been a couple of great guitar safaris this year. And I think we should definitely, we'll talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
But, I'm pulling from every conceivable place you think you could possibly get the gear, whether it's kind of canvassing the normal places where we could all find gear mm-hmm. online or all local sources, or we have a worldwide network of consigners that is, hugely important to us. So people that see the way that we represent gear, they want their gear to be represented as warmly and accurately as the other things they're seeing on our site. And so we'll bring those in and do do the same thing as we would with anything else. And So we're deeply grateful to that network of people, which has just continued to grow and grow. But I love getting out there, boots on the ground. I mean, we went to Tokyo earlier this year.
Yeah, there's a whole Japanese side to this business too that we need to talk about. But go ahead, yeah.
And I mean, that was just a kind of a surreal situation to be having some sushi and having two 50s Les Pauls that we had just picked up that were, you know, under the table.
Do you have
people
in Japan who you can kind of broker these deals with and can show you around? Okay.
Yeah. We have people boots on the ground there that we buy from and that we can sign with, because just the size and the saturation of that marketplace. For one, there's obviously Japanese made guitars. There's everything that Fender Japan does. There's everything that Gibson would do under their kind of Japan exclusive Epiphone banner or Orville. There's Japan exclusive, you know, Gibson branded guitars. There's tiers that exist, hand selected tops and things that only happen through their distributor over there in Japan. There's, you know, Rickenbacker exclusives. There's Gretsch that's made over there. And then we're not even touching all of the lawsuit branded, your Greco, Bernie, Tokai, and then your kind of legacy Japanese brands like a Gaiatone or Tysco or something like that. So, I mean, just there's this incredible breadth and depth of really interesting pieces that we don't necessarily see as much of over here. So that was something really early on with Guitar Bars. We started learning as much as we possibly could, because a lot of that information wasn't even translated.
Yeah.
And bringing those things over and saying, these are really interesting and there's a ton of value here. And then a lot of people in Japan caught on to that and said, hey, you're doing a really good job with this. Can we sell you more of these things? Can you represent these things for us? And it grew very organically.
So give us the 101 on these, because I've seen them on your site over the many years. And like probably a lot of guitarists, I kind of just nod my head like, oh yeah, Japanese only market, you know, Fender. Mm-hmm. But I don't really know, you know, I mean, is Japan the only country where a big brand like Fender will be like, we're going to make an exclusive colorway, and it's not a cheaper guitar by any stretch.
Not at all.
Like, what is the story with these things?
To the best of my knowledge, and I'm sure there must be other examples, I think probably on a smaller scale, but to the scale that the biggest guitar brands in the world do things that are exclusive for Japan, I can't think of any other analog to that.
So Japan, you've got collector culture, love for things American, high quality. These are guitars made in America for Japan with special doodads and color patterns and stuff? Or
There's both. Okay. There's both that are happening. I would say the bulk of it is going to be things that are happening in Japan, marketed to the Japanese domestic market, made at those factories. But there are absolutely, like, for example, before they were doing the thin skin line of Fender offsets in the States with matching headstocks, you could get the Yamano marketed within Japan, Yamano exclusive Jazzmasters and Jaguars in custom colorways, which with matching headstocks. And so these things kind of existed in a vacuum in Japan, necessarily before they existed over here. But Fender Japan is really currently operating on kind of they're creating the scarcity of these things. They're doing ridiculously short runs for individual vendors over there. Okay. And a lot of these colorways, you see them for a day and then they're gone, or they'll do an exclusive for their website where you have to have an IP address in Japan where they'll make...
Really?
Yeah, where they'll make 15 guitars. They have a whole art canvas series. They'll have different artists. They'll commission to do some really exotic stuff on Esquires and Tellies mostly, and they'll make 15 of them. They'll make 30 of them.
Okay.
And it's really beautiful, unique, dynamic stuff. And, you know, we want to provide the opportunity for at least a couple of those to be available in the States. So we'll work with our people over there to bring them in.
And my impression, and I'm sure there's a wide array, but my impression is these aren't like custom shop price. They're like more affordable even when you, right?
Yeah, for sure. They end up, you know, once we take care of, you know, all the associated costs and whatnot, it ends up being something we can market around the price of a USA mainline Fender instrument, yeah. not even like an American vintage or something.
So this is where a dealer like you really comes into play of, as if it wasn't daunting enough for the average guitarist to figure out just the typical Fender domestic line of like, where does this guitar rank?
Sure.
Now we've got overseas guitars that might rank higher, but be priced less. It's all crazy.
It's incredibly dense. And that's part of kind of what's exciting about it is being able to not necessarily be an authority, but be able to be a resource and be able to provide that information with as much clarity as possible. Yeah. Because especially in a day and age where we don't really have physical catalogs anymore to go to, that information can be there and gone so fast and not even translated into English. So we're really grabbing this information in real time and providing a record for it, because it's otherwise it can be very hard to research some of this.
And dare I ask, does Fender hate that these guitars end up coming back to the States and getting sold through you?
I've never heard any, no.
I mean, it is a global economy.
Yeah.
It's going to move around.
The displeasure has not been voiced in my direction specifically.
Okay.
So I'm sure, I hope that they're happy to sell guitars and that someone's celebrating these instruments that might otherwise not make it here.
So when you go to Japan, when you personally go to Japan, mm-hmm. are you also buying a whole bunch of Gaetones and Taiscos and all the other Japan-only oddities?
A little bit. We have to be pretty choosy with those because a lot of them, certain things like Gaetones are beautifully made instruments, but you also can end up with a lot of things that need fretwork from Japan, especially guitars from the 60s and 70s. You get these really tiny low frets. And so we're always balancing what is this ultimately going to need restoration wise to play at a level where we feel confidently that we can sell it. And that's not always the case, especially with Taisco. Yeah. But we are in a position where we will do things for the love of the game at this point. So I just want to see everything go and be the best guitar it can be. And I think it drives certain teams of mine crazy. we're just going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Because it's exciting and it's fulfilling. And that's what we're here to do, is to, you know, create some spark of joy and make guitars go.
Totally. You guys, do you carry any new guitars?
No, not really. We'll take a case-by-case basis. We'll take some things in, usually on consignment from like smaller luthiers and things like that. But 99.9% of it is all used and vintage. And as much as we leverage the Japanese guitar angle, I think as much to fill in informational void and to put useful information out there that maybe doesn't exist elsewhere. I mean, so much of what gets us going is the classic American guitar brands. I mean, we do so much of that.
There's an incredible array of guitars in your showroom at any one time. If anyone's passing through Seattle, like, go to your store. It's incredible.
Thanks.
What is the percentage of acoustic to electric that you sell?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would say it's probably 4-to-1 electric.
Yeah.
But that can be a little bit deceiving in the sense that, you know, we have as many as, you know, 700 or 800 instruments in the showrooms and under the roof at any given time. So, I mean, there's still
that's a lot of guitars.
Yes, it's really the depth of curation across different brands and different areas of interest is one of the things that gets me most excited.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll have, you know, we've got a wall of Fender, we've got a wall of Gibson, but we try to keep a really good deep stock of Rickenbacker and Gretsch. And then, you know, the acoustic walls upstairs, we've got wall of vintage Martins, wall of vintage Gibsons, and then we try to feather in all the other, you know, your Collings and your Goodalls and your Loudons. And
yeah. And what, is Reverb the main channel where people still buy guitars through you, or is it kind of split?
We sure do a lot through Reverb. I mean, it's the biggest one in the marketplace. There's no denying that. I mean, eBay is a dinosaur, but we still We still sell guitars there. And
really?
We sell, yeah. I mean, it's really wherever people feel most comfortable and understand the relationship with their technology is easiest for them. That's yeah. where we want to meet people exactly where they are. So whether it's, you know, through Reverb, whether it's through eBay, whether they're calling up on the phone, whether it's, you know, through our website, you know, there's multiple platforms that people can go to, and we're funneling it all down.
So a new guitar comes in, or a new old guitar comes in, do you post it immediately on Reverb, eBay, and of course your store site at the same time, or how does that work?
Yeah, it eventually, well, it'll make it to all places at the same time.
Yeah.
But there's typically a couple week gestation period for anything from the time it gets through the front door to we're at a point where, you know, we've done the photo set, we've written the ad copy, we've put all the materials together so people can have a deep understanding of what it is they're potentially purchasing, and they can get adequately excited about it.
You make this whole process sound super easy. What's the most stressful part of running a guitar store in 2023?
I think it's just the expectations and speed of an e-commerce geared world, mm-hmm. where we've had to add in more layers of communication to say, this is the expectation for shipping. This is the expectation for how we're packing this. These are the things we have to do to ensure that this gets to you safely, mm-hmm. like some assembly required. Like, you're going to have to put your tubes in. You're going to have to put your bridge back on the guitar, but it's okay because we've marked the position right for you. It's just that really specific, you know, handholding, which we're happy to do. And that's part of the gratifying end of it, is that no matter where you are, if you're absolutely coming into this, you know, brand new, but you have a desire to get into vintage kit right off the bat, that's fantastic. Or you've been in it forever and maybe you've received some things that aren't packed the best, or you've been hurt before by another guitar store and the guitar bar is not going to hurt you. So I think it's just really building in that communication and really building in that expectation that we're doing this at every step the best we possibly can. And, you know, if there is a breakdown at any point in that process, you know, that's where one is really tested on that customer service end of it, right? And just being real humans and being mm-hmm. available to people and being as reasonable and accommodating as possible, so that, I mean, you really have to just kind of, how do you say this? I often have to kind of extricate myself from the situation and look at it as objectively as possible.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
just like, all we want to do here is make sure that you're as delighted as possible with this piece of history, art, and functional tool that you've just acquired.
Sure.
And how do we get from point A to point B?
Yeah.
I know that's a very long, complex way to answer that.
You know, a lot of the acoustic guitar collectors, you know, worry about sides and Lasiak stuff and Brazilian rosewood on old Martins.
Sure.
When it comes to, you know, the electrics are outselling you've got a lot more electrics than acoustics. Are you having to worry about those same exact issues when you're shipping overseas and everything, or is it less of a worry with a lot of your inventory?
I find it's a less of a worry across the breadth of our inventory. The Sides thing is still weird. There's still some opacity to that. There was huge turnover at Fish and Wildlife during our last administration here
yeah,
in the States.
For sure, yeah.
So what it meant to get a Sides permit 5 years ago is very different than what it takes to get a Sides permit now. And it seems like a lot of that institutional knowledge at Fish and Wildlife was just lost.
Oh.
And so really, we've been at a point with, we have had challenges with them.
Yeah, yeah.
But really, I find outside of a very few countries in Central Europe that are still really beating that Sides drum, we don't have problems, you know, sending Brazilian to most places. People would want to mm-hmm. have a guitar with Brazilian on it.
Will you ship amps anywhere?
Oh, yes.
You will?
We will ship. That's another thing that kind of gets me really excited about
shipping
about guitar
amps.
Bar. Well, it's shipping anything anywhere. So like, we've sent suitcase Rhodes pianos to Dubai. You know, we'll send SVT flatback fridge, 810 Ampeg cabinets, you know, to somewhere in Eastern Europe. I mean, we will send anything anywhere and we will pack it in a way that I don't think most people have seen gear packed before. Just the different layers that go into that sandwich and the specific things we're thinking about when we're packing amps. So yeah, we're protecting baffles and face plates and knobs and removing any tubes that aren't in a metal can and really being careful about our void fill. And then you've got layers of industrial bubble wrap. And then we build a box of, half inch, or actually it might be 1 inch hard foam around that. And then we custom box around that. So you get this three layered situation to get your amp. And we've had really good success with that for a lot of years.
Wow. I know you guys post a lot of videos. You got to videotape that the next time you do it. That sounds fascinating.
See, I've gone back and forth on this, you know, with our burgeoning media department. It's like, that's really information I want out there, but there is a proprietary sandwich that I'm kind of proud of.
Okay. Until someone posts an unboxing video from Dubai.
Yeah, I guess there's no secrets really out there. And yes, I would love for people to know how to pack their amps as safely as they can. But yeah, that can be a mess. I have this vision in my mind of an Ampeg B15N flip top that we received years ago, you know, incoming, not mm-hmm. outgoing, where it's just those little rubber gaskets that hold the head to the plate. You flip it around and do its suitcase form, and then that head just falls off into the cabinet, wedges itself very firmly behind the speaker, and you have all sorts of problems. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of thing we think about. It's like when we're shipping an Ampeg flip top, that's three boxes. That's a box for the cabinet. Yeah. That's a box for a head. That's a box for the trolley. And you know, they all get that same level of packing.
The postage must be nuts.
Oh, we have a very intimate relationship with FedEx. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying you're gouging anybody. It's just like the shipping must cost as much as the amp or whatever some of the time.
We definitely get folks who don't understand why we need to charge what we charge for shipping.
And
it's definitely a combination of materials that other people aren't using, the base rate, the labor that's involved, because we can spend, you know, packing a Rhodes is a day.
Yeah.
For as many as two people to get that thing out. So, I mean, really the labor cost is significant, but there's many different ways to run a guitar shop, Jason. I don't think we can be accused of doing it in the least expensive way possible. I think we probably do
I mean, the most common thing I see when perusing vintage stores is like, you know, pickup only for amps. I mean, that's just the most common thing.
That's become a huge thing over the last few years too.
Yeah.
More so than I've seen in the past. I feel like over COVID, I really saw people starting to draw a hard line there and saying, we're not shipping amps anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. What, I mean, you're an analytics driven guy. You've got 800-ish guitars or instruments at any one time. Like, what is the one thing you just cannot keep in stock right now? Like, what is what's been the hottest trend of 2023? And maybe conversely, what's been the thing that maybe was hot a few years ago and is sort of slowing down?
I would say kind of the thing that we move the most of right now are probably Epiphone Casinos.
Okay.
And that's across, and Gibson ES330s, like a lot of thinline P90 equipped Gibson fully hollows tend to be a really
What's driving
big
that?
Thing for us. Well, I think it's the breadth of options available for starters is that, yes, we can have your USA vintage model. We can have your Japanese models across a couple different factories. Even the ones that they used to make in Korea at Peerless have gained real notoriety and people are recognizing a lot of value there. So I think it's being able to get into something that has some real character and some feel to it. They haven't made it for 10, 15 years at this point for any of those iterations. I mean, obviously there are still some casinos being made currently, but that you can get into this exciting, almost visceral vintage guitar thing at a level that you know, maybe you couldn't with some other analogs. So those have been really wonderful for us. I mean, historically, Fender offset guitars. I mean, that's what we built the guitar bar on. That's the firm foundation of guitar bar was understanding your Jazzmaster and Jaguar and Michael and I both being you know, deep Fender offset enthusiasts. That has been a through line for the last almost 12 years that we've been doing guitar and bar now.
That doesn't seem to be slowing down.
No. And I always, because that is something that is an expectation of guitar bar, I want to have as deeply curated a selection of those as possible.
Sure.
And because the Japanese angle of it is so, we're becoming more and more known for that. I'm trying to keep as many of those short runs in as possible. So it's not like you're going to go to the site and not find a deep, we're not going to be sold out of Jazzmasters at any point.
Yeah. At any one time, how many of these Japanese only market guitars do you have on average? Like a few?
I would say safely maybe 40 unique examples at any given time.
Okay.
Yeah, we go.
This
we
is
go
a big deep. Part of your,
it is,
your,
yeah.
your quest. Yeah.
Well, it's fun. It delights us. It delights the people that get the guitars. Plus we get to do all of the, you know, the offset upgrades that we would typically do to anything where, you know, we have our Lawler and our Curtis Novak pickups on hand. We have our Mastery bridges and vibratos and, you know, no matter, and I'm sure you've run into this as well. So no matter how well purposefully built an instrument is, people still want to make it their own and they want to make those tweaks and they want to make those upgrades.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, these Fender Japan guitars, they're awesome right out the gate, but there are of course, you know, things that one can do. And we like to provide those things, have those things in house. And
so do you guys have like a shipping container a month coming or something?
We get boxes every couple of days.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
And of course, there's this wonderful, you know, local Seattle community. There's people coming in the door every day, and we have these opportunities. So it's not all cold and distant. There's a lot of warm, real human engagement.
No, I know.
Happening.
I'm fascinated by this Japanese market stuff. It's just like, wow, the logistics of just moving guitar. I mean, you know how much of a pain in the ass it is to move a guitar out across a state. You know, it's.
I had to take a guitar out of my house and put it in my trunk today. And that sucked, man. I got to go to practice tonight. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we talked about how the guitars come in. We talked about what's selling. What is anything that was hot 4 or 5 years ago, pre-pandemic maybe, like kind of fizzled out in your realm?
That is a really good question.
Or are there guitars that, you know, somebody will try to consign and you'll just be like, I don't think this is going to sell anytime soon.
Well, there is a lot of those guitars I will have if there's merit to them in breadth or depth of curation.
Okay.
So not only do we want to have, you know, all the biggies, I also... We have a whole room in the shop just that we call the robot room because it has a robot on the wall.
Okay.
And that's dedicated to just like all your catalog guitars of the 50s and 60s, your Harmony, K, Silvertone, Dan Electro. We have one of the deepest selections of Moserites you'll find anywhere in the world. And then a lot of our kind of more unique Japanese guitars will populate that room as well. And I don't necessarily expect those guitars to sell quickly. If I buy a K, I expect to be looking at that guitar for a long time. And I love those guitars, but I want people to be able to come in and experience those where they might not get a chance to elsewhere. Or say, you know, Supro National Resoglass guitars.
Sure.
Like just creating that experience for people is more important than the expediency of turning a guitar around and getting it back out the door.
Yeah.
So there's a good chunk of the inventory that we have just to provide that depth and that geekery, because I want the opportunity to engage with people on those instruments that maybe they're not going to find somewhere else.
Yeah. And how far do you guys go? Because you have this repair center. Like when you get a quirkier, like not entry level. I mean, they're not entry level anymore, but like a Silvertone or a Supro, how much work will you put into it versus just like, hey, as is $700.
Yeah. We never do the as is thing.
Okay.
It is always, go for broke with this stuff. Sometimes literally, we send most of our neck resets out of house. We'll do some of that in house, but it's okay. Just how much time we can dedicate to a bench for any particular job.
Is there some cave where people are just doing neck resets for way cheaper than you can in Seattle?
No, okay. that doesn't exist. But yeah, there's always that calculus with something like some Silvertone parlor where the neck is just bowed beyond repair, where I'm not gonna necessarily heat press it and refret the thing and reset it and do all the things that one would otherwise do to a guitar that, you know, an old Martin or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we get that question a lot actually online of, well, what are you not telling me about this guitar? What am I not seeing here? And it's like, no, you actually are.
Yeah.
this is everything. We've been inside this acoustic with the mirror, and we've made sure that every brace is doing what it needs to do, and every crack is cleated or repaired. The pick guard is relaxed, the bridge is reseated, the saddle is at the proper height, the geometry is where it should be. There is one guitar that we did a video on last year. This is kind of a good example of the go for broke.
Okay.
I was called out to, I got a call from someone who their family member had passed away, and they were out in Colorado, and they had two 50-foot trailers that were out in the heat that were full of this person's gear, and they didn't know what to do with all of this. And I said, you know, I don't want to be insensitive to the situation, but you know, if I were to get on a flight tonight and be in Colorado tomorrow, would that be okay with you? Am I providing the service you want me to provide on the timeline you want me to provide it? And they said, yeah, that would be great. So, you know, showed up the next day and the cases were the right color Solex and the amps were the right color Tweed. And we worked out this whole situation and packed 17 guitars and 20 amps into a vehicle and drove them back from Colorado. But the one thing that was in there was a Epiphone Frontier from the 60s, a Dreadnought acoustic, that didn't have a top.
Oh,
it was the neck heel was split in half. It was the back and sides and the neck with the tuners on it. And I said, well, I can't leave this.
Yeah.
Like this needs to be something.
Yeah.
So brought it back in the passenger seat with me and it hung around for a couple years. And then these are the sorts of vintage restoration angle of it is a sort of thing that just gets me really excited about working with all of the talented people within our community to stretch them to, hey, have you done this before? And would you do it?
Yeah.
And you know, would you mind putting a new top on this Epiphone and creating the right bracing pattern and the multiply not like binding?
It has a top now. You got to do something with it. Yeah.
So we had a new top made for it, right binding, right bridge cut, right pick guard. You know, with all of the lariat and cactus and everything that an Epiphone Frontier pick guard should have. And, you know, had our good friend Joe Riggio spray the lacquer to get that very authentic, very specific Epiphone sunburst that's different from the Gibson bursts of the 60s. Mm-hmm. And then to be able to come back to this family years later and say, here's this guitar restored, complete. You know, it was very feeding for us to do it. It was really emotional for them to see this guitar brought back. And yeah, literally, you know, for the love of the game, you know, there's no money to be made in that, but it was a hell of a lot of fun to do.
So I'm hearing you tell that story. And the first question that came to mind was like, when you buy a plane ticket to go look at a guitar collection, do you just do one way? Cause you kind of assume you're going to be U-hauling it back with some gear.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's
how
that's
roll.
What that one was. Yeah.
Yeah. This is foreign to us civilians who usually buy round trip plane tickets.
Oh, you like to know you're coming back. Ah, I understand.
It's just a different world.
Yeah. Or, you know, we was, I got a call to go to Bend, Oregon, a few weeks ago, 1937 Martin D18. Mm-hmm. So yeah, one way ticket into Bend's.
Are people usually calling like a bunch of shops and like pricing out or, you know, sussing out the vibe or
sometimes, yeah. And sometimes that can kind of be pitched as a, you know, give me your best because I'm pitching this all around mm-hmm. town sort of a thing. And for me, that doesn't, I don't like the adversarial sort of a thing. I feel that there's a number of wonderful shops here in Seattle that do really great things. And
yeah,
someone's going to vibe with one of those better than the other. And I actually had this conversation with someone over the phone just last week about an old Martin. I was like, hey, this is the experience you can have here. This is the experience you can have elsewhere. And if you want to bring it to us, you know, I feel like there's enough market data out on this that there's a fair number. And if we can agree that this is the fair number, if someone else is going to, you know, come out ahead of that, that's wonderful. I want this guitar to go wherever it needs to go to maximize whatever it needs to be for you. And we're grateful that a lot of those do come to Guitar Bar and we're able to make that happen for a whole lot of people.
Yeah. All these repair people you have, are they coming out of straight out of Roberto Venn? I know some of them are like work with touring artists. Like where do all your repair people come from?
Well, I mean, for starters, really at the top of that, we have a, you know, Guitar Bar's longtime business partner, Ben Bryan, who mm-hmm. has been in the Seattle guitar community for, you know, well over a couple of decades at this point. Mm-hmm. And Ben has a wonderful reputation. So I lean on him, you know, constantly. It's great to have partners in this. It's great to have people that can share some of that. And Ben's extremely deep knowledge kind of sets a specific tone for that shop. And then, you know, we do have people that are on the road doing touring work. And we're always grateful that they will, you know, create that space and time to be at the Guitar Bar. Because ostensibly it's their time off. You know, these people have full-time, real hard-hitting, long days.
Yeah,
with some pretty serious artists, and it means so much to us that they would come back and also put their efforts into Guitar Bar. We rarely get somebody that's like a first bounce right out of a Roberto Venn because the depth of knowledge that we're looking for and the speed at which we work isn't something that's typically developed in that environment.
Sure.
So we're looking for someone that's typically got a few years under their belt already. I mean, not that we don't want to, we want to nurture those people and we want to provide them with opportunities to do types of jobs that they haven't done before and to gain perspective, especially on the nuances of the used and vintage kit. It can be a completely different paradigm than working on new gear. So we want to provide the space for that tutelage and that mentoring and that being able to build those people into even greater badasses than they already are. Yeah. But we're looking for folks that have a little bit under their belts already. And we find that people that have been on the road tend to have a certain autonomy to their work and understand a sense of urgency that ends up working really well for what we're doing.
I know you have some specific amp only techs. Are there specific acoustic only techs too, or does everybody kind of on the guitar side do double duty acoustic and electric repair and restoration?
We try to fit the instruments kind of to there's people that have greater areas of interest.
Yeah.
Anyone on the guitar side is going to be working acoustics and they're going to be working on electrics, but you know, we have people that are that like their heavier, shreddier music. Mm-hmm. So they're going to get all the double locking, Floyd kind of situations. And then we have people that are more focused on the acoustic side. So they're going to get, more of that work. You know, at the end of the day, we want to make it as feeding as an environment for everybody that's there as possible.
Sure.
So let's try to not only give them the thing that they're most specialized in, but give them the thing that is most feeding to them.
Yeah. And you mentioned briefly, and I know it's one of your most popular videos on the web, Joe Riggio. Like, for folks out there hearing that name, I'm sure there's somebody hearing that name for the first time. Like, give us the 101 on Joe and what your relationship is like working with him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, when we first set up the guitar bar in Ballard, going, oh my God, Fretboard Journal is, they're just down the way.
And like, we still are.
Yeah. There's this, this access and this, we wouldn't, you know, necessarily have enjoyed had we been elsewhere. And for being, you know, a worldwide authority in what you do, similarly, Joe is a worldwide authority in what he does in vintage guitar finish work.
Yeah.
And once again, we're just so incredibly blessed that he's, you know, down the road. He's in Tacoma.
Okay.
So being able to have somebody that does world-class guitar finish work that will be able to nail any vintage Fender custom color and any vintage Gibson custom color with a degree of detail and accuracy and very... Joe and I are, I don't know where to start this. This is such a big question. It's such a meaty question. you know, Joe and I go back to the very beginning of Guitar Bar and actually before that, where at that point he was really doing mostly Fender. And I found that just his custom color matching and his very tasteful relicking was something that was beyond what I was seeing elsewhere. And if we were going to be restoring a guitar, you know, we'd be sending photos back and forth of, oh, this is how much patina is on the bridge and the tuners. This is how the plastics have aged. Mm-hmm. And then that's informing the kind of finish work that he's doing. And then that has blossomed into this whole relationship that he now has with Gibson, where he has officially licensed every Gibson guitar body shape. So I can, because he has his, not only does he restore vintage guitars, but he has his own brand under Riggio Custom Guitars, of which we are a dealer.
Okay.
So that there's things on the kind of more Fender styled side and the more Gibson styled side. But the Gibson ones, you know, if I'm getting a Les Paul special from Joe, that's an official Gibson licensed body shape. And Joe has this relationship with Matt Kaler and the Gibson Custom Shop. So let's say you're buying a brand new Murphy Lab aged gold top.
Yeah.
The gold top formulation that Gibson is using is Joe Riggio's gold top formulation. They went to Joe and said, we can't get this right. Can you give us your secret? So he's just one of those magic people in the industry that we're so lucky to get to work with on restoration.
And I've heard of these little licensing luthiers being able to license for the Gibson shape. Does that go include the headstock, or does Joe have his own headstock?
Joe has his own headstock. Okay. Yes. Sorry. That does not include the open book Gibson shape. That is okay. Body shape.
Where they draw specific. The line.
Yes. I mean, I only know as much as the people I've talked to about this. I mean, it's an incredibly limited program. I think there's you know, less than a dozen people that enjoy that privilege.
Yeah. Okay. But Joe's like the finish guy.
Yes. Joe is the finish guy. There you go.
He is. Is it out of a house or a workshop or a commercial space?
He has a dedicated spray booth and workshop and
got to go down there at some point.
You can see it in our video.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to go back soon. We've got a 61 Les Paul SG that he's doing some work on for us right now. That you know, we'll be capturing that for the YouTubes.
And perfect segue. What's going on for 2024 at Mike and Mike's? Like, what are you focusing on? What's going to be new? You can't. I think you've run out of space in Fremont neighborhood. I don't think you can. I guess you go higher. But
well, I mean, even at this point, and this is something that we try to impart to everybody that comes in the door is that what you're seeing on the floor is not everything that we have. We have hundreds of guitars that don't make it to the showroom because we want that space to be navigable. And
are those held offsite somewhere?
No, they're all in-house.
Oh, okay.
And we will pull anything for you that you've seen online so you can have it in hand and have that experience.
Okay.
But yes, you're right. We've square footage wise in Fremont, we've really lucked out having two buildings adjacent to each other to begin with.
For folks who don't know Seattle too, like this is actually a nice, I mean, there are a lot of nice neighborhoods in Seattle. This is like one of the nicer neighborhoods in Seattle. This is not low rent.
I never dreamed we would end up in Fremont. It was a sincere hope that we could keep the shop near the garage where we started it, just because sure. we had already kind of built that community. But it was, like I said, 2 years of searching and just a very specific situation that happened where there was a building that had been with a family for generations, mm-hmm. and we pitched them something that I think was going to honor that architecture and use that space in a really unique feeding way for the community.
Yeah.
That's why we ended up there. Okay. I don't think, you know, the other thing that was trying to get the space was CrossFit. And they said, between the two, I think this one's going to be more feeding for the family legacy to put the guitar bar there.
This is like the classic bidding war over a house where you write the handwritten letter back in the old days.
I did that for the house I'm lucky enough to be living in. Absolutely did that. But as far as what's the guitar bars doing in 2024, it's really the media department that's where I'm focusing so much of my energies these days, because, you know, as I'm sure you understand as an editor for our creative team, I've either written or overseen over 14,000 pieces of ad copy for the various guitars that we've had. I mean, every one of these gets in hand and we go through all the specifics and we tell the history of that instrument when we're building it for e-commerce. But at some point we're asking ourselves, well, is this just fast food? It's here and it's gone. And what can we create that is lasting for people, that is a resource that they can come back to, that is easily searchable. And so building that out on our website and on our YouTube channel, where we can tell these stories more dynamically, and figuring out exactly what kind of stories we want to tell and what people are responding to and mm-hmm. where that need is. That's kind of the big thing for 2024.
Yeah. What is your YouTube channel? I mean, do you have a videographer on staff, or like how does that all go down?
Well, it's something that we're still really building out. We do have a production company that we work with, and we have our whole 2024 slate more or less figured out.
Wow.
And, you know, for me, it's, you know, writing those scripts and figuring out what guests are going to be coming in, and again, what kind of stories we want to tell. And we actually have someone in-house now who is helping build that out for us as well, just from a scheduling standpoint,
sure.
because we really want to be doing as much as possible of that in the new year, where it's not only just me talking to the camera and giving you vintage guitar information, but where we're really bringing people into the space and having those conversations. That's more feeding for me, and I really enjoy that.
Sure.
And so that's what we're kind of building to there.
Is TikTok a priority?
TikTok is not a priority. It's it's definitely something that we have a TikTok. We don't really engage with it as much as we would like. But again, that's something that we've been building out in-house really over the last couple of months, where we have somebody now who is building structure around how we can be engaging with our social media more deeply and more frequently, because it's pretty much just me there on the Instagram. It's like, oh my God, it's this time of night and the shop's closed and I can throw a few guitars together in a photo. And I have
I
this
know the feeling well.
Little moment to talk about this thing that I'm excited with, but you know, 90% of it just passes me by during the day. And it's like, oh, I'd love to talk about that. That's something I would love to engage with a broader, internet community on. And there's only so much time in an 80-hour work week, my friend.
An 80-hour work. See, it's not as easy as you made it sound. You're working 80 hours a week.
70 to 80 consistently for the last 11 to 12 years.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
That much? How much of that is at home? Do you work a lot from home? And then,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm in the shop a couple days a week at this point, but so much of it is remote at this point. Yeah.
Are you still playing music?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Playing instrumental surf rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what are your guitars of choice for that band?
Oh, I'm a I used to be a utility guy for that sort of a thing. So I would play like the Vox Continental organ, and then I would play Moserites and Jazz Masters for the guitar end of it. But now I'm playing bass, which is kind of my favorite thing in the world. I love bass. So I've got, old 61P bass that I've been thumping around on, and a couple pre-CBS Fender Jazz basses, and the bread and butter bass thing. But man, is bass fun. I love that so much. So yeah, I'm finding a little time actually going from here to go meet up with the fellas and
what's play the band a little name? Surf.
The Desolate Coast.
The Desolate Coast.
Yeah.
Do these Japanese specific market Fenders come in bass variations too, or is it just guitars?
They do. Well, there's the guitarists in this band are definitely slinging some of that stuff. There's a couple of these more high-end Gaia tones that make an appearance.
Okay.
A Ventures model Moserite from Japan that shows up in there. So yeah, they're all over it.
Well, Mike, I'm going to let you go hang out with your band. And
thanks.
Thanks for representing Mike and Mike's. Thanks for your support. And it's great to hear. I'm always fascinated how I'm sure people are with talking to me of like, how does a business run in 2023? And you gave us the lowdown.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. That was Mike of Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar. I hope you loved it. I learned a lot. I love it when I get to ask all the dumb questions I'm usually kind of scared to ask some of my friends. So I got to do that today, and I loved that under the pretense of running a podcast. I hope everybody out there is doing okay. I hope you are surviving the holidays. If anybody needs a little extra help, go listen to the Guru Sing podcast we recorded just a few weeks ago. It'll help. Till next time.